Today on Against the Grain. Public schools have long been a battleground for the right, but since the COVID pandemic, the right has had the wind at its back, enlarging its ranks with parents frustrated by school closing and masking mandates. Education journalist Laura Papano discusses how the right has sowed panic over library books, gender-neutral bathrooms, and the supposed teaching of critical race theory, not just to take over school boards, but to cast doubt on the value of public education itself. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. There's a war being fought over public schools and school boards, which has only intensified since COVID, but now with less press coverage. My guest today argues that the stakes are high, that, in her words, when you control schools, you control society. Journalist Laura Papano is the author of School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. Laura, you start the book with a summit of Moms for Liberty, initially a parent group that came out of COVID, which targets public schools and the content that's taught in them. Tell us about its origins and its significance to the fights being waged around schools.
Moms for Liberty and I have now gone to all three of their summits. They began during COVID with, with the kind of frustration that a lot of people were feeling around their children's education and masking. And at these school board meetings, and we saw a lot of them on the news back then, you saw a lot of outrage and anger, but that's where people found each other. And the Moms for Liberty really used that as a launch pad for, a whole panoply of attacks on public schools. And when I went to that first summit 3 years ago now in Tampa, Florida, I went, I registered under my name and went as a journalist. I was fully expecting to just kind of, what's the argument? Does this make sense? What's going on here? I just was really in a kind of search and discover mode. And when I got there, I was frankly stunned at the extremism that I saw. And what I saw was a ballroom full of about 500, quote unquote, Moms for Liberty, who were hearing almost breathlessly for the first time that their children were being indoctrinated in schools, that sending them to a public school for 30 to 35 hours a week was like sending them to a Maoist reform prison camp. The teachers and school leaders were trying to change the gender of their children. And all of these things that, we know to be completely untrue, but given, as you point out, the seeds in COVID and all that people, quote unquote, did not know about the school day, people were ready to believe this. And I mean, we've only seen this accelerate. What was interesting was that there wasn't a lot of pushback at that first summit in Tampa, Florida. But by the time they were in Philadelphia a year later, what was striking about that Moms for Liberty gathering was that there were so many protesters. They were just, but what was also interesting about that was that everybody who was just discovering information that first year, by the second year, they were all on board. They'd all bought in. They all had the language. They all had the lexicon of how this was going to go. And of course, they had the five Republican presidential candidates there as well. But what was striking was the amount of protest. I mean, we were told not to wear badges out on the street. For the opening reception, we were ferried in buses because even though it was just a couple blocks. And there was so much security. And I just went, a little over a month ago over Labor Day to the one in Washington, D.C., and there were no protesters outside. And the conversation inside the month, there were protests, I will add that were kind of counter activities around the city. But there wasn't this kind of show outside of the hotel. And what was striking to me about this year's event was how baldly political it had become. Certainly, politics have been woven into this from the start, but there was no conversation about making schools better or educating students. This was about strategy. It was about, how do you get power? How do you get control? How do you push back? And it's very much about political organizing. And I do think that those moms who first showed up and the ones who have joined, one of my frustrations as an education journalist is that we are exactly seeing schools being used as a political platform, because this is not about education.
Right. You write that when you control schools, you control society. So presumably there are people who have joined groups like Moms for Liberty who think they're changing schools. But what do you think is driving that ambition to change things on a much larger scale?
Well, I think the kind of top of the ticket, if you will, Steve Bannon at CPAC 2 years ago made the observation that school boards are the key that picks the lock. And I know that's been quoted over and over again, but what he was articulating was the fact that local level school boards have a lot of control over how things go. And we've certainly seen this. And what was interesting about Bannon's observation then was that back in January 2022, a group called Patriot Mobile, which is a Christian cell phone company based in Grapevine, Texas, and Patriot Mobile decided to form Patriot Mobile Action, which is a PAC and a political action committee. And what they did is they funded their super PAC, so they couldn't directly fund candidates, but they funded, they kind of helped birth a whole group of local action committees, and then funded 11 school board races and in Texas, and won all of them, flipping 4 school boards to far right control. And what it was a kind of demonstration project, because shortly after that, you saw Project 1776, which was the group that was Trump's answer to the 1619 project. So Project 1776, and you can go to their website today and you can see which school board candidates around the country they are endorsing and supporting. Moms for Liberty also formed its own PAC and is supporting and endorsing school board candidates. And I saw this kind of at play back in Tampa that first year. And Ron DeSantis was, was the first, one of the first speakers. And there was a great deal of focus and attention on the moms who were running for school board. And repeatedly during the summit, they were asked to stand up and everyone, there around them was applauding them. And Ron DeSantis made the announcement at that time. He said, for the first time ever, I'm going to endorse candidates for school board. And I mean, when you think about it, it's not what we've seen. We've not seen governors endorsing school board candidates. But I remember when he had the Moms for Liberty candidates stand up, you could read their body language. They were so incredibly flattered to not only be recognized, but to have Ron DeSantis endorsing them. But in that same breath, I recognized that what he was doing was ensuring for himself a ground game. He was ensuring, and it didn't end up working out very well for him, but it's a strategy that we've seen over and over, is that these moms have been a kind of underappreciated and highly organized, group for a very, very long time. And you know, their labor has been largely under the radar and dismissed. But what happened with the Moms for Liberty in this instance was really a situation where moms were having their labor recognized and seen and used and tapped. And if you want things organized, you know, ask a mom, seriously. And so the result is that suddenly, you know, the top tiers of the far right, you know, parties recognized that moms were really valuable, and not only that, that school boards were valuable, and school boards could be gotten for very little. When I looked at the school board races in Texas, I noticed that turnout in some cases was 8 to 10% of registered voters. So it took very little money to flip and elect, to flip a school board, to elect far right candidates, and to flip a school board. And what struck me is when I was down in Texas during those first school board races with the Patriot Bubble, I was, you know, I was collecting literature and people were sending me campaign literature, and I was looking at where this stuff was originating. And lo and behold, you know, I'm discovering that it's out of a firm in Kansas City, Missouri, that happens to also do national political work for Ron DeSantis, Ted Cruz, and you know, and Glenn Youngkin. I mean, so what you're seeing is you're seeing national political strategists involved in local school board races. And what this does is it takes schools and school boards from being kind of community enterprises. I mean, I never knew what anyone's politics were in my kids' schools or my schools, and I didn't care and it didn't matter. But suddenly, these are now becoming politically charged spaces. It's not that they've never had political brushes, but in a very specific way, they are being kind of, you know, deputized to be part of this larger far-right drive.
Well, let me ask you about the component of that, bearing in mind that you're saying that we can't see these as, you know, just these local struggles, that they are fitting into national agendas, that there is national funding for them. But I also wanted to ask you about the history of this kind of parent, or let's say mom activism on the right, which seems to have really come to a head during COVID and subsequently. But does it not go back much further? I mean, I'm thinking about opposition to busing in the 1970s and other efforts in defense of, you know, segregation. When we think about mom activism, especially mom activism on the right, because of course there are mothers and parents organizing also on the left or in the center. But when we think of that kind of activism on the right, how far back does it go?
Well, it goes back a while. But I think you're right to kind of put a point on it in the 1970s. I think in the 1970s, you had a couple of interesting things. You had, and we're seeing the kind of result of them now. You had the mom activism. As soon as you brought that up, and the, you know, the busing and opposition, obviously we think of Boston, but I also think of that group Pony U in upstate New York, which started organizing against book bans. They had a Watkins Glen far right, you know, gathering at which school board members from Long Island, Island Trees City School District, you know, some of them attended, and at that event they were passing out lists of, you know, bad books. And lo and behold, we saw that suit kind of make its way on Long Island. And that was led by a woman who was, you know, ardent in her organizing. And she actually ended up showing up at Kanawha County with the Heritage Foundation with all of the activity around the objections to textbooks in those schools, which led to bombings and even some deaths. You know, they're 1970s, but if we also look at what was happening in parallel in the 1970s, we have to look at kind of religious activism. And what was really, striking about, you know, the 1970s is that if you look at these organizations that we consider now kind of like leading what's going on, you look at the Heritage Foundation, 1973 started, Cato Institute, 1977, the Leadership Institute, 1979. And what you saw in the 1970s was really the rise of the Christian right. And at first you had, you know, leaders like Jim Baker and Oral Roberts, but theirs was very much of a religious fervor. They were as one kind of scholar put it, you know, they were trying to build a Pentecostal amusement park. Whereas when Jerry Falwell came along, his mission was to remake America. And that switch from trying to gather believers to trying to impact the country, the state, how we govern, was striking. And what was interesting, though, is that at first there was this whole battle, if you many people recall, to get, you know, God back into school and get school prayer. And then some people got wise, and they, after meeting, ironically, with Jimmy Carter, who was born again, they were very disappointed that Carter said, absolutely, I will not support, you know, prayer in the school. But then what we saw happen was that rather than kind of trying to push that angle, they changed the language. They changed how they talked, and to language of rights and equality and opportunity. And you started seeing, you know, when gay marriage came up, those were special rights. They embraced the kind of language of liberalism. And then you saw, as a result, going a little further, parental rights. And this is where we kind of rejoined the women, the mom activism, is that parental rights became particularly, I first, as a journalist, heard that language when I was covering sex ed debates in Newton, Massachusetts, on the, you know, right after, you know, we were still kind of, you know, concerned deeply about AIDS and AIDS education, and sex ed curricula was being revised to include condoms, the word homosexuality. And that's when you saw the Christian right really object, and you saw the Christian Coalition form groups and some groups that were, you know, loosely, you know, affiliated with them. And what they did is they argued, well, these are our parental rights. And of course, now we are hearing the phrase parental rights over and over again. And if you look at the Moms for Liberty site, what they are arguing for are parental rights, transparency, indoctrination, stop, the end to indoctrination. All that sounds really good, but we're having this kind of a language problem, because what does transparency mean? Does transparency mean that moms get to march into school libraries and pull books off shelves they don't think any child should be able to read? Does it mean that anything a teacher says in a classroom is suddenly under scrutiny? Does it mean that every curricula, some legislatures have passed these laws that, require curricula to be available for review? So, I mean, transparency, parental rights, and this is all done under that kind of auspices and that language. And indoctrination is another one of those phrases that, I mean, obviously, nobody wants their child to be indoctrinated, but I mean, I'm not sure what hanging, you know, the Ten Commandments on the walls, how that jives with that. So there's a lot of, we're having a big language battle right now, and everyone's trying to claim liberty, freedom, parents' rights, parents. I mean, it is just, in some ways, it's fascinating, but deeply, deeply troubling.
Journalist Laura Papano is my guest. She's the author of School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So can one generalize about the mothers who are involved in this kind of right-wing politics that's targeting school boards? Is it possible to generalize their class backgrounds and locales? Do they tend to be in the suburbs? Is it broader than that? Who are these people?
Well, I mean, I think what was really fascinating for me when I was doing the research on the book, I obviously went to the hot spots. I traveled to Texas. I traveled to Tennessee. I was down in Florida. I was in eastern Pennsylvania in Bucks County. I went up to New Hampshire. And at that time, that was where, those were the places, you know, among a few others, where you were seeing just a lot of action. And those, are, in many ways, where are the places where this was somewhat predictable. I mean, these are red states. But within each of these, I want to make 2 points. One is that within each of these, there is not a monolith. Obviously, this is more of a suburban issue, but it's not unheard of in urban areas. I remember doing some reporting in Texas and talking to a mom who was originally drawn into creating one of these groups that ended up being kind of like Patriot Mobile adjacent, because she was, I think rightly so, upset that in her school district, some of the kids in the high school were able to take tests over and over again until they got a satisfactory grade, whereas in other of the high schools, students could only take the test once. And as a parent, I could certainly see that you could be very upset about that, because that, you know, affects GPAs and kids applying to college and all of that business. So she started this group and started talking with other parents. And of course, she found some of these parents at school board meetings. And she's very quickly gathered a whole, you know, pretty large, you know, group of parents. And then she told me, she said, I started showing up at our meetings and seeing that people had QAnon bumper stickers. And she was like, what's going on here? And she saw her frustration at a legitimate kind of school issue. And let me just say, by extension, there are a lot of legitimate frustrations that as parents, it's our job to bring up and to air. But what she saw was she saw that her whole kind of parent organizing was in effect being hijacked. And she ended up leaving the group. And I did not use her name in the book because she was facing attacks by the people who are still in the group. But she said, I'm a conservative. She said, I carry a 9mm every day of my life, but I don't think my 18-year-old should be able to buy an AK-47. And so what you're seeing is like, is this kind of splintering among, and I think we're seeing it all over the country. I'll give you another example. This time last year, I was doing a lot of reporting in North Idaho in a rural district. And this also speaks to your nationalization of local issues. And I had been following in West Bonner County a case where the school board, you know, someone lost by 8 votes. And I remember talking to the person who lost, a very active mom in the district. She said, people didn't show up to vote because they just assumed I'd get elected. Well, what happened instead is you had a majority far right district that then got rid of curriculum, sent it back because it contained social emotional learning, Sesame Street characters. And so the district again was left without any English language arts curriculum for grades K through 6. And I talked to a teacher who took a picture of her bookshelf and had very few books. She goes, by October, she goes, I'm out of materials because we just have not replenished them over the years and they're out of print. So you have this situation where ideologically this group is taking over and getting rid of something that they don't really know anything about, and that the school board had previously reviewed and chosen and unanimously accepted. And so when I went down there last election day, it was a very fierce, they recalled, the moms organized, moms who describe themselves as conservative, Republican, and religious, organized because they wanted to take their school district back because they valued public schools in this rural district. And what you saw was them successfully recalling, but then we had an election. So then there were fierce races for those seats. And what struck me as I was going to the different polling places on election day, and these, and just to paint a picture, I mean, we were driving miles and miles, me and my photographer, you know, down some dirt roads, and we end up at a lodge, a Masonic lodge, where there's a voting place, and there are tents outside, and there are people who are showing up to vote. And I was listening to the one of the candidates, one of the proxies for the candidates, arguing to voters entries, he's going to keep boys out of girls' bathrooms. You know, we have to stop transgenderism, which is, you know, a slur. And that transgender issue became a huge, huge issue in the district. And I saw it on materials and, you know, you saw it on things that were being circulated on websites, on mailers. And the truth of the matter is, that wasn't the issue in the district. The issue in the district was financial. It was budgeted. They hadn't passed their levy. You know, Idaho was like number 50 in terms of funding for local schools. They were, you know, faced with threatening to cut sports and after-school activities. So transgender issues were not the issues, but it was the national language that had filtered down to this rural community and became one of the hot issues in the race. So you're seeing this kind of national allegiance to particular stances and views and language, which are, in a sense, you know, poisoning what is really a community exercise, which is electing local neighbors, residents, to serve with the best interest of your community in mind. So I think that is one of the things that we're seeing in terms of that, you know, national to local. And it's, you know, and it seems to have just be getting worse. It seems to be, you know, a train that just can't stop.
Well, do you think part of that is, and what you were just describing, how an issue that really wasn't an issue at the school district level became an issue because of national framing, potential national funding, that it's possible for people to make something about something sort of wacky because in these local elections and school board elections, you have, you know, generally pretty low voter turnout. So that this is something that could be captured by the right, which might be much harder at elections where there's a higher threshold for voting.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. Because what we're doing is we're having, you know, we're using rhetoric, which people recognize from the national conversation. And, you know, people are frightening them in. These are emotional calls out, right? This is not a kind of a logical, let's look at the problem and, you know, consider some solutions or answers. This is an emotional activity where some people are just have a gut feeling like some things are wrong.
Well, tell us, for listeners who might not know what social emotional learning actually is, what is it and how you see parallels between the Red Scare of the McCarthy period with what's going on today, the Christian right, these moms groups weaponizing social emotional learning as a way of controlling and diminishing public schools?
Great question. I mean, so social emotional learning is really about how do we get along with one another? And one of the early originators of this idea was Pam Siegel at Open Circle. And she had been a teacher, and in 1987, she kind of came up with this Open Circle. But I interviewed her back when I was writing a column for the Boston Globe, and she said, you know, I realized as a teacher that if my kids were worrying about who stole the glitter pen and blamed it on somebody else, then whatever lesson I had planned was going out the window. So she said I needed a way to, you know, have a community and a conversation. And I actually did, I visited a number of, their whole group of different programs that I and I visited schools that were having these. And at the beginning of the day, very often or at different points, they would just gather everyone in a circle. And it was a way of people, of students connecting with one another. And increasingly, social emotional learning is about, you know, how do you take turns? How do you raise your hand? I interviewed a kindergarten teacher in California after, you know, COVID, who said, because children had spent so much time on their own with an adult, you know, ready to be commanded to deal with whatever needs they had, they weren't really great at negotiating one another. And, you know, her point was, she said, we would have to, she goes, social emotional learning became, don't bump into your friends. You know, somebody is speaking, wait till they finish. I mean, just basic kind of etiquette sorts of things, right? So it's not mind control. It's like, how do we get along with one another in a society, in a culture? And I remember after going to the first Moms for Liberty Summit, I was at an airport and they had claimed that social emotional learning was this horrible Marxist indoctrination. And I called up my daughter, who is a principal in Dallas ISD, and at that time was teaching math. She was an assistant principal in charge of math and was teaching. And I said, Molly, do you do social emotional learning? She goes, yeah. I said, well, what does it look like? She goes, well, everyone does a math problem. And I say to them, how did it go? And she said, by me understanding where they're getting tripped up, how they react to it, she said, I am able to help them overcome those concerns because I can be very specific with what they are. And it's really enabling kids to do the work themselves. So there's this big kind of argument out there by the far right that, you know, we shouldn't have social emotional learning. We should have, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic. But social emotional learning is what lets you do the reading, writing, and arithmetic because everyone feels like they're okay. But to your point about, you know, how this relates to the Red Scare, I mean, look what we're talking about. We're talking about fear. We're talking about emotions. And the Red Scare was exactly that, this kind of, you know, rabid worry. And we're hearing some, you know, we hear some of the same language now. I was at, went to the Schlesinger Library at Harvard and also the Gutman Library at Harvard and actually looked at old pamphlets and messaging from the Red Scare. And two things stood out to me. One, the names of the groups and committees formed to, quote unquote, fight communism sounded so benign. It's like Parents Defending Education, which is a far right group. The names of these groups, they all sound really good. It's like, who wouldn't want that? But what you see is that there are very clear agendas behind these things. And the agendas are really about creating fear so that people will follow your guidance to, you know, in this case, we're seeing today people roundly attacking public schools and wanting to pluck their kids out and have voucher systems. We're seeing all kinds of attacks that are really meant to challenge, you know, what's going on in public schools. And we saw that in the Red Scare. We saw that it targeted under the guise of communism. And you would see, I mean, I looked at old newspaper articles from around the country. And if a teacher or an educator was merely called for questioning, they lost their job. I remember reading in Wayland, Massachusetts, reading a kind of monograph of what was happening historically at that time, when if someone's house was painted red, there was belief that maybe they were sending secret communist messages. So what you see is you see a ridiculousness and overreading into these things. And I think we're edging into that now. I mean, it's about what team you're on. It's not about reading. It's not about math.
Laura Papano is my guest. We're discussing her book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. Well, one arena of struggle around sort of ideology and panic about ideas corrupting students is something that you mentioned in passing earlier, critical race theory or CRT. How is the right focused on critical race theory as something endangering America's children? And can you give us the context in which this particular fixation emerged, because it didn't happen in a vacuum?
Right. It's not organic. the whole phrase of, you know, there is such a thing as critical race theory, which is, a graduate level construct that was developed in by scholars in the, in the 1980s. But what we saw was Chris Rufo, who is a far right, he calls himself a journalist activist, but he very effectively turned critical race theory from just a, something that really did not apply to something that on Twitter, he said, we are going to take this quote unquote brand and we are going to basically remake it so that when anyone hears this, they will have be flooded with negative thoughts. And he very quickly took critical race theory, which did not apply in K-12 schools whatsoever, into the boogeyman of that children were learning things that they shouldn't learn and were being indoctrinated. And he did it extremely effectively and just, shortened it to CRT. And then suddenly, it's a Trojan horse, as he yells, a Trojan horse for CRT. All of this nonsense that we are seeing played out. And, what's striking is I was really interested in how quickly this arose. So a friend of mine who was a linguistics professor at Yale, they have these kind of engines for searching to see how, words arise. And I said, would you be willing to kind of search critical race theory and CRT? And lo and behold, it was really not very much part of the lexicon or part of the public discourse until, just after Chris Rufo, did this on Tucker Carlson. He raised it up Tucker Carlson and followed up repeatedly to the point it just absolutely soared. So it's very clear that he was driving this. And what I found particularly frightening was when in an interview with Tucker Carlson, when he looked right at the television and basically called on Donald Trump to abolish this from all training, in government training. And the next day, there's an executive order that's issued doing just that. And I mean, that's, incredibly frightening. But what we've seen is that CRT has morphed into anti-DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we're seeing that legislation around the country. And what's interesting is, if we recall the Students for Fair Admissions, SFFA, versus Harvard and UNC, and that Supreme Court ruling, which challenged the way students were admitted to colleges, which really led a serious blow to any racial considerations in admissions. And what we're seeing now, and in fact, I'm working on a story on this, what we're seeing now is how different, far-right conservative groups are now launching similar kinds of lawsuits and complaints against pipeline programs, affinity groups on college campuses. And we are seeing in the K-12 arena legislation in which, teachers are frankly now afraid to talk about anything related to, race or, ethnicity, because they don't know what the consequences are going to be.
And one area which has both imperiled teachers, but also put students at great risk is the the right's fixation over transgender and queer kids or transgender bathrooms. Can you tell us how that cause, if we can call it that, that fixation by the right has unfolded in the context of this targeting of public schools?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I'm just really, just stunned and struck by, because, you know, it has been a cause of the far right for a very long time, you know, to attack LGBTQ students plus students. And when I was doing some reporting, I was in Bucks County, and, the consequences are pretty serious for students. And what you see is, you know, at the time, now Bucks County has since changed their school board, but at the time, the kind of plea that we shouldn't be talking about sex in schools. I mean, kids talk about sex on the playground. Gender identity is just part of, existence. You can't outlaw that some families have two moms or two dads, or that some people feel like they're born in the wrong body. You cannot outlaw that, but we are trying very hard to keep it from being a conversation or acknowledgement in schools, which those policies have absolute consequences. And to get back to Bucks County, they created some very restrictive school board policies around LGBTQ plus students. And that gave a kind of tacit permission to those who wanted to harass them. And I remember sitting at a pizza place talking with a group of students who said in their middle school, at every passing period, they would walk through the school and kids would shout and harass them. And I am not sure if you're going through that multiple times a day, every single day, I don't know how you learn math. I don't know how you concentrate. So it's one of these counterintuitive activities. Like, if you want to make schools better, if you want kids to learn, everyone has to feel that they belong, and everyone has to belong. So it's been an inexcusable, dehumanizing strategy and attack. It makes me so, so angry, because kids need to figure out who they are, and it doesn't matter what that looks like. It matters that they, show up and are invited in.
Laura Papano, one of the places where so many of these obsessions of the right, critical race theory, transgender and queer kids, even social emotional learning, come to a head is around what books are in the library of schools. Now, of course, book bans, unfortunately, are not a new thing in the United States. And the right has a long history of deciding that some books are, perverted or demonic or inappropriate for children. How has the latest wave of book banning, how was it initiated?
The modern book ban, one of the things I date it to was back in 2021. There was a state legislator in Texas who, decided that that there were books that were problematic. And, so suddenly there was Matt Krause was his name, and he created a list of 850 books that he said, did not belong in school libraries or school classrooms. And what Krause's list did was he issued this in October 2021, and by mid, I think November 1st, schools were supposed to report to him, where the books were, how many they had, how much they had paid for them. Just this huge, undertaking. And I remember seeing one of the activists on Twitter who does a lot of who's actually a campaign finance expert, took a photo of boxes of books being wheeled out of a local school library with a scrawled on them, Krause's list. But what this did is this created this notion that there were some quote unquote bad books out there. Now, if what was beautiful was that the Texas media had a field day looking at some of the books that were, you know, some of them had nothing whatsoever to do with sex or gender or race. They were just, you know, while a majority of books that have been banned have been dealt with LGBTQ themes or race, but some of them were like, you know, encyclopedias of, you know, the discovery of inventions. I mean, some of the stuff just made no sense. And he's steadfastly ever refused to say how he did it. But here is an important point, is that he did it while he was running for attorney general, not very effectively. And what happened as a result was that he got a lot of attention. It didn't end up helping him in the long run, but I think a lot of what we're seeing is attention-seeking behavior.
Well, and you argue that ultimately this isn't about what's good for students. And, you know, in some ways goes even beyond schools themselves. But you also argue, and I wonder if you could expand on this for us, why you think that we shouldn't be misled to think that all of these energies are being put into concerns about one issue or another, and recognize that what actually is happening is a kind of wholesale attack on public education itself and a way of delegitimizing the value of public education, throwing into doubt whether this is something that should be made available to every child. Can you explain what you see as the end goal here?
Yes. And, you know, it's funny that you bring that up and you put it so eloquently. I was just emailing with my editors about this very issue this morning. And what we're seeing is, you know, they're trying to soften the target, right? The target is public education. And we're seeing it on coming from so many different levels. It's the books, it's the curriculum, it's at the state level, it is race, it is gender, it is everything. And, you know, it's showing up in terms of vouchers. So the solution, many say, throw up their arms and say, you know, public education is not working. We should get rid of it. We should just, you know, parents' rights, parents' choice, parents' liberties, parents' quote unquote educational freedom. You choose where you want your child to go to school. So, you mean, so this is why we're seeing all of these voucher programs, you know, multiplying across the country. And what's so troubling about this is that the voucher programs really have very little oversight. I mean, when I was looking, I did a story right when Florida became the state with the largest voucher program. They were always large because of their population, but they expanded it. And I looked at the data just before their expansion. And I noticed, I went through Excel sheet after Excel sheet, and I found that only 4% of voucher schools in Florida were nonprofit, non-religious, and accredited. So what we are essentially doing is we're taking public money and we're just throwing it out the window. And we're giving it to schools that may or may not be good, schools that may or not be legitimate schools. I mean, one of my frustrations is as a journalist, I want to say, okay, you're giving them money. These are the schools that are accepting the vouchers. How are they doing? Right? I mean, my daughter in Dallas, I'm really proud of her. She got her school from nearly about to, you know, be failing to a B in a year by really drilling down. So I wanted to drill down in Florida and say, okay, what's going on here? You cannot find out how they're performing. So what we're doing is we are spending public money for basically, my belief is that we are enriching certain people. I had, I was looking at some schools, voucher schools in Florida, in which they had been built by people doing real estate deals. You put in a school, you get a nonprofit board because that's required, and then the nonprofit board, school board, pays an exorbitant rent to the real estate the owner. And I had a pastor in Texas telling me Same problem in Texas. So these are tools for transferring money. And my deep worry is that, you know, we're seeing in voucher places where vouchers have caught on. One, if they're universal vouchers, that means anyone can get them. We are seeing people who are already sending their kids to private schools taking advantage of the vouchers. And my great concern, and I think we're seeing this already, evidence of this happening, is that low-income kids, kids without the ability to drive themselves to a different school, a charter or a publicly available school, are not going to be in schools where they're going to get an education. They're going to be in under-resourced schools. We're going to see schools close. I interviewed someone in Florida who, you know, she was waiting at the bus stop with 11 kids because their parents were going to work early. And she said some days, and the day before I interviewed her, she said, the bus never came. She goes, I called and I called and I called. And they just never sent a bus for these kids. She goes, and then they walk out into the day, middle schoolers and high schoolers. She goes, nothing good is going to happen for them that day. So it's a very, very worrisome. What we're doing is we're abandoning a very large group of students in America because no matter what you say about vouchers in private schools, there are not enough of them to serve all of the students. Nearly 90% of students in America attend public schools. They're not perfect, but we need to figure out how to make them work because as a structure, as an institution, as a vehicle for educating our society, we need them to work and to exist.
Laura Pappano, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Laura Pappano is the author of School Moms: Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. We have a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. She's a journalist and writer. Her other books include Inside School Turnarounds, The Connection Gap, and she's co-author of Playing with the Boys. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Thank all of you who pledged during KPFA's fall fund drive. We're still a bit short of our goal, so if you haven't donated, help us close the gap and make a donation right now at kpfa.org. We thank you so much.